We are live from Art Basel, Miami Beach. The tent we are in today is untitled. And we're bringing a great show to you. This is actually the first time we're going live. We have a philanthropist in Puerto Rico that has invited us to do a show. But for Discussions of Truth, and I am the host, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. I'm right here with you on Wynwood Radio. So this is the first time we have been out of studio, even though there has been invite and prepping. We're hoping for the future to broadcast with Ricky Rosseo out of Puerto Rico. But welcome to the show today. Last week, we hosted David Janda, MD. He's the host of Operation Freedom on WAAM Talk 1600. He's an orthopedic surgeon, and what a conversation and discussion we had with David last week, urging all to look into the medical industry. Okay, didn't discuss too much about vaccines, but from a surgeon that had been appointed to be part of a medical team under the first Bush, actually, is that 41st that just passed away, H.W.? He was appointed by H.W. And had worked under Reagan. So his career spanning Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and his alarm could not sound loud enough that all Americans, and this extends, this isn't just American, this is globally, you need to look into those that manage, and primarily what David spoke about was the insurance companies that are manipulating health. Okay, excellent. All right. So we're getting a few glitches out here. So, David Janda. And again, iantrottier.com, iantrottier.com, impeachmassmedia.com, stopmassmedia.com. All three of those websites go right into an archive where we're coming up on 2 years, 2 years of doing this program, and we're coming up on the 100 episode mark here. All of those episodes are available on my website, iantrottier.com. And I urge you to look into Mixcloud, and Mixcloud has all those episodes as well. Right, okay, excellent, yeah. So, and go to WynwoodRadio.com right now on Instagram and check us out live, Instagram live right now. What we've done from studio in the past is we've done Periscope, which is, I believe it's a Twitter live basically, or a Twitter-owned live slash TV, if you will, type production. But right now on Instagram, we are live, and it's a beautiful setting here. We've got South Beach to my left, and to Adrian's front. The waves are rolling in. The temperature is very delightful, and Adrian's got himself a really nice little setup, really nice booth in here. Some great vibrant colors, some pinks, roses, blues, light blues, greens, black. So if you're listening to this and you are local in Miami, please do stop by. In about 10 minutes' time, we will be hosting Andy Lee Roth, who joined us a few weeks ago. Andy joined us. He's a VP of Project Censored. Project Censored has been around for a few decades, actually. They're Petaluma slash Bay Area based. They dig into the sway that is mass media, mainstream media, hence impeachmassmedia.com. And that is, if you swing by the booth, you'll see the shirt right behind me. You can get those shirts on the website, namesake website, impeachmassmedia.com, for a gift of $50. So, recent developments on the program. We received Dr. Philosophy, J.P. Lindstrup, last week, who spoke about what's going on in Yemen. And what we're looking at in Yemen is a possible genocide. Three quarters of the Yemen population are looking at possibly being starved. So then, what we do is we turn to he's listed as one of Atlantic Monthly's, if you're familiar with that publication, 2009 bravest thinkers. Mark Zuckerberg is on that list. Bernanke is on that list. Other great citizens of the world are on that list. But coming up here, January 2nd, so we'll be opening up the new year by hosting Dr. Alex Deval, who is a British, I want to categorize him as a sociologist because although he's written many books, his current book is called Mass Starvation, The History and the Future of Famine. So he'll present his case for what is termed Operation Starvation. And he doesn't speak of the 1945 U.S. Army Air Force's initiative regarding Japan under Admiral Chester Nimitz. What he speaks of, in its primary use, the verb to starve is transitive. It's something people do to one another, like torture or murder. Mass starvation, as a consequence of the weather, has very nearly disappeared. Today's famines are all caused by political decisions. This is a direct quote from Dr. Deval. He's currently the head at Tufts University. Yet journalists still use the phrase man-made famine, as if such events were unusual. The organization I work for, the World Peace Foundation, has compiled a catalog of every case of famine or forced mass starvation since 1870. Now, these numbers are alarming. And again, we'll be receiving Andy Lee Roth in about 6 minutes on program. But since 1870, he's saying those numbers have killed 100,000 people. There are 61 entries on that list responsible for the deaths of, and this is the striking number, 105 million people. He goes on to say about two-thirds of the famine deaths in this period were in Asia. And about 20%, not in where you think they may have come from, 20% in Europe and in the USSR. Just under 10%, i.e. Ethiopia, come from Africa. Okay, so these are well-designed and engineered programs of starvation. And that is what Dr. Lindstrom was talking about last week that's happening in Yemen, whereas the population there is being forced into a starvation, and nearly three-quarters of that population could be facing mass starvation and death. That's a genocide. The biggest killers were famines that resulted from political decisions, among them the Gilded Age famines, the Great War famines in the Middle East, including the forced starvation of 1 million Armenians, the Russian Civil War famine, Stalin's starvation of Ukraine from 1932 until 1934, now known as the Holodomor, the Nazi hunger plan. The Nazi hunger plan, designed to starve people, okay, not weather-induced. And that's a whole other topic, geoengineeringwatch.org, under Dane Wigington. As we know, for decades now, the military is capable of manipulating your weather. Yes, right here on South Beach, where hurricanes come seasonally. And this program started 2 years ago when the Zika virus hit the shores here. Okay, not via a hurricane, but the hurricane did follow. Okay, and it killed millions of honeybees. Hence a producer out of LA, honeycolony.com, is her website. Asked me to write an article for her. Okay, I have no journalism background, folks. I simply started this program to deliver you things about your government, things about your society, the world we all collectively live in, that you probably don't realize are going on, like the Zika virus being patented, and the owner of that patent being the Rockefeller Foundation. That is fact. You can Google that. That's public information. Okay. If you have the proper credentials, you can order a vial of the Zika virus to study it. Okay. And then on the flip side, in Wynwood District of Miami and right here on South Beach, you're looking at the pesticide that was being used. And there was a small little correlation fighting that, because that pesticide that was used here called Nalid, that was banned by the European Union. Banned by the European Union. And that's why this fellow in Puerto Rico has invited us to do a show, because I'd like to get Ricky Rosseo on the program to talk about why he was rejecting that shipment. It's a known neurotoxin, folks, that the population of Miami, South Beach, and Wynwood were sprayed with. Okay, what difference does it make to me? Well, it's known to cause microcephaly. So women that are pregnant with a developing fetus, it's known to cause brain deformation. That was the same pesticide that was used for the Zika virus. Okay, so going into starvation, innocently, we welcome Alex DeWall into program. He's received his PhD in social anthropology from Oxford University in 1988 for his thesis on the 1984 Darfur famine in Sudan. He's widely considered an expert on Sudan and the Horn of Africa. Currently, Alex is executive director of the World Peace Foundation, as I read that quote, and the research professor of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's previously held fellowship at Harvard Humanitarian Initiative at Harvard University. You can visit Reinventing Peace. That is his blog for current publications, current articles. Alex is related to British barrist John DeWall and journalist on the Caucasus, Thomas DeWall. Okay, so that's January 2nd. So we open up the new year by hosting Alex DeWall. We're going to be closing out the year with Scott Bennett, who, as the late Adrian had alluded to, is a whistleblower, okay? And he's a former U.S. Army Special Operations Officer, 11th Psychological Operations Battalion, and he'll be talking to us about what he wrote, which is it's a book, but it's also a report. It's called Shell Game. It's a psychological whistleblowing, okay? So 6, 7, 8, maybe a year now, we hosted Charlotte Iserbit, and Charlotte Iserbit spoke about how our education is being manipulated. Okay, these aren't lightweight guests. These are guests that have worked for presidential administrations, not campaigns. Okay, she was a top-ranking director of the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan, and Reagan fired her because she was opposed to the program called BEST, which basically all that was doing was, this is why she was opposed to it, because it was taking the power away from the parent and giving it to the state. So if you're a parent, how do you feel about the state having that authority to say, no, this is what's good for your kid? Okay, and if you're a member of the PTA, you would most likely object to that. Okay, so next week, we'll be bringing on Andy here shortly in a number of seconds. Next week, Jefferson Morley. He's a Washington, D.C.-based author and veteran journalist of over 30 years. His novelistic nonfiction books explore untold chapters in the history of the American nation. He applies his investigation reporting talents to 15-year career at the Washington Post. Morley combines granular detail with storytelling verve to capture unknown realities of subjects as disparate as the Central Intelligence Agency. What we're going to be talking about with Jefferson is what Trump is alluding to with this whole deep state. He talks about deep state. What is the deep state? Why is Trump even talking about the deep state? Why didn't Obama ever talk about the deep state? Why didn't Clinton ever talk? Why didn't Bush? Why didn't these people ever talk about it? Why is it that Trump is talking about the deep state? And what is the deep state? So a journalist of over 30 years in the business, in the industry rather, is going to be talking about deep state. And that links to JFK. I was actually in Dallas yesterday on a layover. I didn't get to Dealey Plaza. But what I caught, what we're going to be talking about with Jefferson next week is our man in Mexico. Okay, I personally lived in Mexico. I love that country. I speak a little bit of Spanish, right, Adrian? A little bit. I don't know if you... Okay. And Winston Scott is the person that he wrote a book about and the hidden history of the CIA. Okay, so this is what we're talking about next week. Jefferson Morley, I'm going to cut to a break. You are tuned in to Wynwood Radio, and this is Discussions of Truth. You're listening to the voice of Ian Hamilton Trottier. Check me out on Twitter and Instagram, and go to us right now, Wynwood Radio right now on Instagram if you like, and follow watch us live. I'll be right back with VP of Project Censored, Andy Lee Roth.
lazy old light from your lazy old sun. You make the rainbows and you make the night disappear. You melt the frost, so I won't criticize my sun. From your lazy old son. Lazy old
son. Okay, back live. We are at 12th and Ocean. This is Art Basel, an incepted in Basel, Switzerland. I believe they have two or three, at least three art festivals around the world. Miami Beach, I understand, is the largest of those three. I think Tokyo, Basel, Switzerland are the other two. For the Miami Beach area, it brings in about 100,000 guests during this week that are out of the area. We have with us today a very special guest who we had with us a couple weeks ago. Andy, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent.
Good afternoon, Ian.
That is a wonderful connection we have. Andy, would you please tell listeners again who you are and what you do?
Yes, I'd be glad to, Ian. My name's Andy Lee Roth. I am the Associate Director of Project Censored, and at least for our purposes this afternoon, what's relevant to know about me is my relationship to the project and the project's mission to inform people about the importance of a truly free press for what we know and what we can do as a democracy, and how Project Censored tries to bring to greater attention the really excellent and important work of independent journalists and news outlets around the country and in some cases around the world.
So excellent. So Andy, you know, when I think of California and specifically the Bay Area where you're coming from, I think of the Berkeley protests and, you know, students being opposed to this or opposed to that. And I think that's great because that sets a precedence for the rest of the nation that looks on and says, hey, wait a second. You know what? We can raise our voice in opposition. You know, we do have freedom of speech. And we can say, no, I don't like this president. Or, no, I don't like this governor. And Project Censored started doing that for us in 2018 quite a way ago. This isn't Project Censored, isn't
yes.
something new. We're talking about 1976.
Yeah. Right, yeah. The project was established in 1976 at Sonoma State University, which is kind of in the northern part of the Bay Area, where Carl Jensen was a professor of sociology and communications. And Carl came to academics out of a background in journalism and public relations and even advertising. So he was very sensitive to the ways that news stories are presented and sometimes how they're spun. But he had the kind of deep history of the origins of the project is that a student asked him how it was possible that Richard Nixon had been reelected in 1972, given what was known publicly at the time about Watergate and the Watergate break-ins and and Nixon's own involvement in orchestrating those. And Carl found that he didn't have a satisfying answer. But like so many student questions that are deep, this led him to begin looking at, well, how did the corporate press cover the Nixon's re-election campaign and the role of Watergate? There was no mention, Carl found, the night of the election, there was no mention at all on any of the network TV stations of Watergate. It was simply invisible. And out of that experience, Carl and his students at Sonoma State University began tracking systemically, well, what are the corporate media covering? And that led him to coin a phrase that's now become commonplace. The notion of junk food news originates with Carl Jensen and Project Censored. The idea that there's news that is titillating with a can of potato chips or Pringles is, but that when you finish consuming it, much like those Pringles, you're left with stomachache, but you're still hungry. So all these years later, we're still doing what Carl started doing at Sonoma State University in the second half of the 70s. We're now the project is now expanded to encompass some 2 dozen college and university campuses across the United States and up into Canada, and so we've now got a network of every year several hundreds students and faculty who help us identify and vet important but underreported stories from the independent media.
That's great to hear, Andy. Let's go back to Carl's findings there in Watergate. What was the most alarming thing, apart from the fact that Richard had been reelected, what was the most alarming thing that he had found? And then how was he able to get traction? How was he able to get outside of his students, people to say, oh, wait, hold on a second here. There's something deeper here that looks like it's being covered.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it was the power of kind of systemic inquiry, right? Carl and dozens and dozens of his students over the years that he was director first began just tracking this. And we have to kind of take ourselves back in time, if only imaginatively. At the time, the way Carl distributed the top 25 list of stories that he and his students put together, the list of the important but underreported stories, those were circulated as mimeographed copies. They were physical print copies. What I think lifted the project to greater status was when some of the local independent papers, including Bruce Brugman's Bay Guardian, began covering those top 10 stories. And that's another kind of tradition in the good sense of the term that continues to this day. So Censored 2019, our latest book, we've gone from mimeographs to a website and a book. Our latest book, Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion, came out in October of this year. And since it appeared, I was just checking up on this yesterday, and there are, I believe, at least 18 independent news weeklies around the country, everywhere from Vermont to the Coachella Valley down in Southern California and Spokane, Washington. Across the country, independent news weeklies are covering some of Project Censored's top stories from this year.
Excellent. Excellent. So let's get into some of those stories. What on that list right now, Andy, what is the most pressing story?
I think it won't sound super sexy when I first start to describe it, but our number one, but in fact, I think it's incredibly pressing. Our number one story this year is a global decline in the rule of law as basic human rights diminish.
Oh, that's pretty important.
Yeah, the rule of law sounds rather abstract, right, to a lot of people. But what we're really talking about when we talk about the rule of law are fundamental rights, like the absence of discrimination, the right to life and to security, due process, freedom of expression and freedom of religion, or the right to privacy. All of these are, in effect, fundamental rights that, according to a study published earlier this year by the World Justice Project, their Rule of Law Index 2017-2018, around the world, these basic human rights, the basic rule of law is diminishing. They aren't just making these claims up out of thin air or some ideological axe to grind. The Rule of Law Index report that that the findings are based on draws on a survey of over 110,000 different households and 3,000 experts from 113 countries around the world. So this is a massive empirical investigation, as we'd say in my field, sociology, right? There's real data based on the experiences and the claims of real human beings, whether they're private citizens or experts. And what the World Justice Project found is that overall rule of law scores have declined in 71 of the 113 countries around the world in the last year or two. So these are challenges that anyone interested in kind of making the world a better place have to confront, right? There, as one of the people commenting on this report, a professor of law at Yale University, Sam Moyne, right, said, this points to a crisis not just for human rights, but for the human rights movement.
Sure.
And so when fundamental rights are falling prey, right, as we have a kind of a backlash against globalization and an increasing division between the rich and the poor, this story of the declining rule of law, not just in the United States, although it's evident here too, I would assert, but around the world is a major news story. And again, like all the other stories in our top 25 list every year, if we're talking about this story, that means when students and faculty in that network that I mentioned earlier researched this story, they were unable to find any significant coverage of this topic in the corporate press. In this case, uh-huh, we found one story. In January of this year, Newsweek published a story, but the story that Newsweek published was based on the independent news report that is the highlight of our number one story, a story originally published in The Guardian out of the UK.
Andy, are you finding, certainly you're finding allies that you can trust in? You mentioned fake news being a main issue for all Americans. It's something we're fighting. We know as a matter of fact that in the past few decades, the ownership of the mainstream media outlets, that's movies, that's newspapers, that's radio, is shrinking dramatically, which means that the final decision-making is going into the hands of fewer and fewer and fewer people. And mm-hmm. So, therefore, as an independent voice, as an alternative voice, you're looking at combating, again, to bring this up, fake news. Mm-hmm. How are you... When you find an ally, what are you doing to cross-check and make sure that you can have complete confidence?
Right. Okay. Well, good. I mean, I would say in the introduction to this year's book, my Project Censored colleague, Mickey Huff, who directs the project, and I argue that there are two key approaches to fighting fake news, so-called. And the first of those is to identify, to expose and counter specific instances of misinformation and disinformation. And we do that, for instance, to some extent in each year's book we have a chapter on what we call junk food news, which I mentioned earlier. So news stories that are they're trivial and they distract attention away from real and important stories. The other way that we have to fight fake news, though, is goes deeper beneath the surface, I would say. You have to look beyond specific instances of fake news, no matter how outrageous they may be, and identify, well, what are the larger social and cultural factors that make fake news persuasive in the first place, right? Put another way, you know, if we have to look at both the content of fake news, but also the contexts in which fake news is produced and circulated. And there, in terms of, how do we actually do these things? One of the things that I do with students in my introduction to sociology classes, when we get to the section of the course where we focus on news and journalism, is we look at actual news stories and we simply try to identify, for every claim made, what is the source that provides the evidence for that claim. And many times in news stories, the sources will be government or corporate officials. Uh-huh. And you can then think critically about, is that information likely to be factually correct? Is it likely to be, oftentimes it is, because many reputable news organizations are, of course, fact-checking their material before they publish it. But even in cases where, you know, that process has been done successfully, who's quoted and what their interests are in their status as a newsworthy source is something that people have to take into account. This is where I think of fake news as being kind of the tip of the iceberg. It's what we see above the surface, but the mass beneath the surface is the role of news as the news more generally as propaganda. That's of a broader critique of the corporate news media that is part and parcel of what you were mentioning a moment ago, Ian, the concentrated ownership that so much of what is presented to us, as media, in the media, especially as news, is the product of an increasingly small group of corporate entities.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then there you've vetted your sources, Andy, and you've mm-hmm. said, look, you know, we've cross-checked. These are great quotes. These are solid leads. Solid quotes. What are you doing then to expand your viewership and say, mm-hmm. because it's almost an uphill battle, right? Because that larger hand is going to try to squelch your voice, and that's symbolic of what we're talking about here. Generally, our rights are diminishing as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the right to know is one of those fundamental ones. I know it's not always popular and sometimes controversial to invoke the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. But in the Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19 is the one that says the right to information, the right to share and to hear information is a fundamental human right. Some ways an expression of an ideal, and the question is, well, how do we make that ideal actual? I think one of the crucial elements I mentioned earlier, obviously, independent news weeklies uh-huh. and independent media, much like discussions of truth here. Provide crucial outlets for the project to spread awareness, to raise awareness of the kinds of stories that are not getting covered in the corporate media. I would say that, we at Project Censored have a vested interest or a not so vested, an open interest in maintaining net neutrality, because the Project Censored website is a crucial way that we reach out to a global audience with the information and analysis that we undertake. And then, speaking of radio, Project Censored has its own radio program, which originates out of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley.
Excellent.
And we're on the air on nearly 50 channels, 50 stations, rather, across the nation each week. And so, I talk a lot in public presentations that I make about the idea of a networked news commons. And each of the words in that bear some unpacking. It's a network, but not in the sense of a television network that's owned top down by, General Electric or some other big corporation. It's an actual network of people, and it's focused on the presentation of news and the analysis of news and journalism. And it's a commons in the sense of that it's not run as a for-profit operation. We at Project Censored obviously have bills to pay, and we depend on donations from individuals to keep the project going.
Yeah, sure.
But we aren't, unlike NBC or MSNBC or pick your corporate news outlet of choice, we're not in it as a money-making business, right? And
right.
So, you know, we all, it bears reminding, Les Moonves, the CBS executive, has been in the news lately, but it bears reminding that during the last presidential election in 2016, Les Moonves' comment about Trump, then the candidate, was that, you know, what Trump was doing in the campaign may not have been good for America, but it sure was good for CBS. It was good for their bottom line, he meant. And so, you know, I think we have to talk about the ways in which we together form a network, and we do it because, not because we're after the profits that may come from it, but because
right.
we believe in making a better society.
Yes, exactly. And Andy, can you share with us any political allies that you may have, whether it be in California? Well, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, today, I'll put in a plug, because today, if you tune into the corporate news, it's pretty much an ongoing love fest in myth-making about George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States. And so just in terms of, you know, I would say people who have encountered some of that might want to look to some alternative sources to be reminded of the full picture of who George H.W. Bush was as president. And so Paul Street has a great article in Counterpunch. Kevin Gastola has an article published today in the outlet Shadowproof. Mehdi Hassan in The Intercept has a great article on the ignored legacy of George H.W. Bush. And each of these people is going through and reminding us that, you know, in 1988, George H.W. Bush ran a racist election campaign. You know, in Iraq, he made a dishonest case for war 13 years before we had lies about WMDs. Similar thing, Operation Just Cause in Panama, 1989. So there's a ton of corporate myth-making about who George Herbert Walker was as a president. And by way of thinking about, you know, allies, I would say, you know, independent news sources, Kevin Gastola at Shadowproof, people like Paul Street writing for Counterpunch. Although I don't agree with everything they publish, The Intercept is often a crucial source. I think in many ways we live in a golden age of independent journalism here in the United States.
Yeah.
The trick, as always, is that it's not on the tallest, brightest pedestal, right? The tallest, brightest pedestal is reserved for the corporate news outlets that have the big advertising budgets.
That are making money off of wars.
That are making money off of wars and the destruction of our environment and the downplaying the importance of addressing climate change, and on it goes. But I often use a food metaphor. I mean, I think about, you know, McDonald's serves millions and millions of hamburgers every year, right? Famously, as their billboards advertise. And a lot of people know McDonald's as an enticing treat. But imagine across the street from the fast food restaurant is a farmer's market.
Right.
And it doesn't have an advertising budget. But if you go there and think about what your $6 or whatever will buy you, you'll come home with healthier options and it'll probably taste better because it's fresh. And I think about news in the same way. The corporate version is a fast food, junk food version of nutrition for citizens. And by contrast, the independent press, so, you know, outlets like Mint Press News, Counterpunch, Truth Out, all these other organizations that we cite when we report the stories in our top 25 every year, are the equivalent of the commerce market. They're bringing you, and here I'll just take this metaphor to its absolute limits. You know, it's organic, it's locally sourced, it's not got preservatives. You know, the metaphors play out in terms of They're not dependent on corporate sources as the only newsworthy people they turn to for information and perspective. They're not embedded with the U.S. military when it comes to reporting U.S. foreign policy. And so independent journalism is to me really like the farmer's market, with the kick that, like, as people who participate in farmers markets know, you know, the rub is always, oh, but that costs more. People can't afford that. But the fact of the matter is, like, when it comes to both farmers markets and independent news, it doesn't cost anything more to get the healthy, locally produced version. It just takes a little more effort. You have to go out of your way, because the pathways in a corporate society like ours are all designed have us delivered immediately to the big corporate outlets, whether it be for food or for news.
So, Andy, part of this censorship growth that America and the world population is experiencing, but certainly as American, I'm saying, I'm reaching out and I'm saying, Americans, you're not realizing, i.e. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts or whoever it may be, you're not realizing that, nor was I, a couple years ago, and that's why I started doing what I'm doing. We're simply not realizing. We've been deliberately dumbed down, a la Charlotte Isabit, if you're familiar with her book. And there is this, again, there is this growth of censorship. So therefore, have you encountered? And one of the, from my view, is that one of the kind of quick ways of combating any growth, any growth of an alternative angle to actually getting into any underlying truth, a Nixon Watergate, is quickly deemed conspiratorial.
Yeah, right.
How were you dealing with that at Project Censored? How were you fighting that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, so there is that notion of, oh, you know, much like fake news has been weaponized as a term to shut down discourse, so too the term conspiracy theory, or the variance on that term, right? All you have to do is say, oh, that's just conspiracy theory. And then the presumption is that any further discussion only reveals the extent to which the people advocating whatever the conspiracy is have tinfoil hats on or heads in the sand, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, anyone who's spent any time online looking at news knows there are some far-fetched, quote, conspiracy theories out there. But we also do live in a world where there is an incredible consolidation of power, not only in media ownership, but in terms of connections between, you know, the corporate elite and our alleged political representatives. And so the idea that there might be conspiracies, and therefore there might be a need for conspiracy theories, is something that we at Project Censored have addressed for a long, long time. And I think that the number one thing is to be careful. Like, when we hear those terms being used, are they being used to shut down conversation or not? But I want to go back and pick up something that couple themes in your question that you mentioned. That you just mentioned. One is this idea of censorship in the United States, and the other is this idea about why people might disengage from the news. So first on the idea of censorship, a lot of people, when they think of censorship, the first thing they think is, well, that may happen in other countries, right? That censorship is the hallmark of a totalitarian state, where news is controlled by the government, and everyone in the country knows that the news isn't real because the government controls it. And that's not necessarily the case here in the United States, where we have powerful constitutional protections for a free press. But what we do have in the United States, and this is what I mean when I talk about beneath the tip of the iceberg, news functioning as propaganda, we have a lot of what I think of as self-censorship in the United States. And that is real in its consequences as well. Here I would just point quickly to our number five story this year, which is a case of actual censorship in the United States. It hasn't been well covered at all in the corporate press, but the Washington Post Earlier in the year, we learned the Washington Post had banned its employers from using their social media accounts to criticize the Post's advertisers and other sponsors.
Wow.
So here's a case in the United States, in you know, our time today, of a major, you know, one of the major newspapers censoring its own employees.
Right. That's and that's Jeff Bezos owned publication, I believe. Isn't that right?
The Washingtonian report documented that not only was this policy in effect, but that Post employees were encouraged to snitch on one another.
Wow.
And that the threats for using their social media in a way that could be deemed harmful to the Post's being terminated, being fired from their jobs. So when people say, oh, censorship never happens in the U.S., that's something that happens in totalitarian states, we have to confront the reality that, you know, the Washington Post, and as far as we know, you know, this is secretive. This wasn't, this policy wasn't supposed to be public. But documents were leaked. As far as we know, this policy remains in place.
So
the last point I wanted to pick up as a thread from your really rich question, Ian, was you know, why are people disengaging from the news? And I think here there are two things that are hallmarks of corporate news, where independent news provides a meaningful alternative. One, people disengage from the news because so much of it is negative and depressing, therefore. And then in many cases, the news comes off as rather boring, to be honest. I mean, I wouldn't say that about all news stories, but I can tell you from, you know, candid remarks by students in classes that I teach, that students will say, oh, man, it just bums me out. Or they're so cynical that just like, ah, oh, you know, another tale of corruption or abuse of power.
Right.
But the other is there's sometimes, and it takes longer to draw this out, but sometimes they find the news boring. Which, you know, I mean, I guess I can understand at some level, like, you know, that it's certainly easier for me to open the page to the entertainment section and read about the latest band or movie than it is to dig into a heavy article on, you know, financial corruption or something. But I think both of those points, that news is negative and news is often boring, independent media provide an important alternative in the sense that the news, there are positive news stories that aren't just positive in the kind of Hallmark card sense of firefighters came and rescued the cat that was trapped in the tree.
Sure.
But there are good news, constructive solutions type stories that focus on communities coming together and acting collaboratively, collectively to address problems that they face. And I'll just mention in passing several of these from our top 25 list this year. Regenerative agriculture as the next stage of civilization.
Wow.
Indigenous communities around the world helping to win the legal rights of nature. And a story about digital justice, how internet cooperatives around the country are resisting rollbacks on net neutrality. And each of those stories, I know we only have a limited amount of time, so I won't propose to talk about them in more depth now, but if people are interested in those stories, they can go to Project Censored's website, projectcensored.org, and look at all the stories on this year's top 25, and they can see our archive of all our 42 previous years of stories. But I mention those stories right now because in some ways, some of the most underreported stories, the most censored, if you will, in the corporate press are good news stories, where good news is, as I say, this substantive, meaningful version of good news, where there are solutions and there are outcomes that are positive. It's not all doom and gloom. And every year, we try to highlight some of those stories as part of, because we at Project Censored see ourselves as part of this kind of movement of trying to promote constructive and solutions-oriented journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it perhaps the topic might be boring until until it hits home. Excuse me.
Well, right, and I think those stories where there's solutions, where you see like, oh my gosh, the people in Detroit who live in neighborhoods that are deemed too poor for the big internet companies to feel it's worth their while, that it would be not profitable for them to offer internet access there. When you read about the communities like that in neighborhoods of Detroit, where they're literally building their own internet and they're getting training in how to build and maintain that infrastructure, that to me is like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's not boring. That's inspiring.
Yeah.
And I think partly why those stories don't get the coverage that they deserve in the corporate press, because they provide us with a view of an alternative that isn't a corporate-driven, corporate-framed alternative of what our country could be like, what our communities could be like, right? That there is the kind of technical know-how. It's mind-boggling to me. Like, I wouldn't know how to begin building an internet for my neighborhood.
Sure,
but
sure.
That's what communities in places like Detroit and around the country are doing as a response to the fact that the big telecom companies won't bring Wi-Fi to their neighborhoods. They can't get access. They can't get online.
Incredible.
So I think that's not boring. I think that's inspiring. And I think, again, there's a reason stories like that are underplayed in the corporate press, because it suggests, look, you might not need to rely on your big internet company to actually have access online.
Andy, from left field here, your opinion, could the rash of, it seems like I'm using the word rash because it seems like it's appropriate, the rash of California fires, and trying to hit home here and say, hey, maybe some of these things shouldn't be boring. Could they have been prevented? How could they have been prevented?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, anyone who lives in Northern California knows that there's no love lost for Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E.
Great.
And on a personal note, my sweetheart, who was an undergrad at Berkeley in the 80s, told me, they used to write their, when they paid their bills each month to PG&E, they'd write their checks out to pigs, greed, and extortion. And those checks would get cashed anyway. So I'm not an expert on this by a long shot, but I know that in the aftermath of the Camp Fire, there were yet again stories going around a lack of maintenance on PGE's part had perhaps not caused the fires, but had led to their burning with the kind of intensity that they did. Now, that's, I think it's important to immediately say that is one kind of link in the chain of causes that led to those catastrophic fires. But it is a link nonetheless, and there's a long track record. Again, as I say, anyone who lives in the Bay Area will know, of PG&E putting their profits before the safety of their customers.
Right.
Certainly the explosion in Richmond a handful of years ago that PG&E is still trying to make financial compensation for. So I think, again, I don't want to go off the handle and suddenly become one of the conspiracy theorists that we were expressing skepticism towards earlier. But at least some of the accountability there, I think at least some of the attention when we're having discussions about these catastrophic fires has to be focused in that case on PG&E as an entity.
Yeah.
But look at the bigger one here, that the 800-pound elephant in the room is, we know now definitively that climate change is intensifying the effects by creating longer seasons of heat, by allowing, all over California and up the West Coast, the invasion of the bark beetle has been precipitated by changes in temperature. And so we can't talk about these catastrophic weather events without talking about climate change, even though, of course, that's what the corporate news media does.
Yeah.
Right. They talk about weather, and we at Project Censor talk about climate.
Right. And maybe, maybe a possible deliberate dependency, i.e. Monsanto, on genetically modified organisms or foods, and consequence of the honeybees dying. But anyway, so there's lots of different angles. Andy, What there at Project Censored, what take do you folks, if any, have on the Federal Reserve System?
That's a major topic. For
In a
sure.
nutshell, give it a couple minutes here.
I think I may try not to I may dodge I may dodge your question on that one, Ian, and just say that you know, in terms of
we'll save it, Ian.
You know, one of the most massive operations in the country right now is the Department of Defense, and you know, the Pentagon just underwent its first audit ever after having claimed for years that it was inauditable. And you know, I think if we're talking about like where, you know, follow the money, as the phrase goes, keeping tabs on that story is a really crucial one. And in that regard, Dave Lindorf just has a fantastic new piece out on the Pentagon that people ought to check out. So
excellent.
Yeah, but the Federal Reserve, you'll have to get me on another time on that one, I'm afraid.
Hey, we'll do it. And for all the Canadian listeners, because we do have a following there in Canada, Paul Hellyer would be a name that might entice you. Next week, folks, we will be hosting Jefferson Morley. This is Discussions of Truth, Wynwood Radio. Andy, thank you so much for joining the program. I look forward to inviting you back on. Lots of great information for listeners to walk away with, and that's what we're all about, is popping those questions into our brains and then verbalizing them. Andy, do you have any last words here? Do you have any last words that you'd like to leave?
Thanks so much, Ian, and I'd just ask people if you're interested, or encourage people if you're interested, check out our website, projectcensored.org. We've got all the top 25 stories and much more there.
Excellent. Andy, have a great day. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Ian.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored. He's the vice president. Clearly, he's done a great amount of research on a number of different sociological topics. But folks, we are sociology. We are a society collectively. I urge you to question authority. Take them to task. Go to my website. Look at what I do and look at really why I do it. Broadcasting from Art Basel, Untitled Tent. This has been, again, your weekly edition, Wednesdays at 5 p.m., Discussions of Truth. I've been your host, Ian Hamilton Trottier. Until next week. Be awesome.